Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with John Banville, also known as Benjamin Black.
Oh, I write completely differently as Black and as Banville. Banville writes, first of all, with fountain pen on paper. Black, he writes directly onto the computer, which I thought I would never do.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Esmeralda Santiago discusses her new novel, Conquistadora.
Anna, for me, is somebody that probably did exist, but the culture didn't allow for women like this to be celebrated in any way possible.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. John Banville is one of the most acclaimed authors in the English language, winner of the Man Booker Prize for his novel The Sea, but he also has a second identity as Benjamin Black, the author of increasingly successful and admired mystery novels. Janet Maslin in the Daily Times says his latest, A Death in Summer, reads with effortless flair, period piece cinematic ambiance and sultry romance. I'm delighted that John Banville's here. You are very serious, accomplished literary novelist, as we say here, but you're also Benjamin Black. How did that happen? When did you start writing these novels and why?
Yeah, I hate that distinction. You know, when I started publishing, there was just fiction. There was good fiction and fiction that wasn't so good. Now there's something called literary fiction, and I'm not sure what the rest is. I don't like the idea of genre. I started out in 2004. I had just finished The Sea. And I started to read Georges Simenon, whom I had not read before, not the Maigret books, which I don't like very much, but what he called his hard novels. And I was astonished by the effects that he could achieve with very small vocabulary, very straightforward style. And I thought I would try to do something like it myself, and I wasn't sure if I could do it, but went to stay with a friend in Italy, sat down one Monday morning, and by lunchtime I had written about 1,500 words, to my astonishment, because poor old Banville would be lucky to write that in a week.
And you have a character who reappears in the books. Who is he?
He's called Quirk. He has no first name, which is a kind of homage to Richard Stark's great character, Parker, in the series of wonderful crime books from the 60s. Quirk is a pathologist in a Dublin hospital. Although he's middle-aged, he still thinks of himself as an orphan. His past is a darkness. And I think that that's the source of his insatiable curiosity. He's constantly curious about people, and I think that's what drives him. He's not so much interested in the morals or in clues or in finding things out for their own sake. He's interested in people's secrets. And these books are set in Ireland in the 1950s, in Dublin in the 1950s, which was a time of great secrecy.
Why?
We were in the clutch of the Catholic Church. The Church for us was what the Communist Party was for Eastern Europe. We only discovered this when we got older, how unfree we were. And everything was hidden, as we have discovered to our horror in the past 5 or 10 years. We've discovered just how extensive the crimes were that were being committed, mainly against children in those days. And the trouble is that we all knew it, of course, in the way that one can know something without knowing it. But we didn't know the depth of it. We didn't know how dreadful the times were. And when I started doing these books, I promised myself that I would not give my characters the benefit of my hindsight. They don't know the things that we know now. So they accept their time as being their time, as we all do. We all assume that our own time is, you know, is perfect in its peculiar way. I mean, we also assume that it's dreadful, but we assume that it's a kind of finished, you know, because we're here, time is somehow finished. But, you know, as we discover later on, time flows. So my characters are locked into the 1950s.
John Banville, a number of critics, including recently Joanna Cavena in The New Yorker, points out that in what we don't like to call your literary fiction, you're with just consummate precision, mastery, with a sense of the tonal effect of every phrase you use. But as Benjamin Black, you write somewhat differently. Are you conscious of these differences in prose, or do you just write in the manner that suits you as you go ahead? Are you changing anything as when you become this other novelist?
Oh, I write completely differently as Black and as Banville. Banville writes, first of all, with fountain pen on paper. scratches out a few sentences a day. Black is disgracefully fluent. He writes directly onto the computer, which I thought I would never do. What I'm trying to do, I suppose, is that, you know, I always say that what you get with Danville is the result of concentration. What you get with Black is the result of spontaneity. I like to think that Black is spontaneous, fluent and fluid, and I like to think that the reader will read it in the same way that it's written. But Danville has to poke away at sentences over and over again until he gets them as near to perfect as he possibly can. Sometimes Banville leans over Black's shoulder and says, that's an interesting sentence. And Black says, no, thank you. It's staying. It's staying as it's written. This is just fine. And then sometimes Black invades Banville's territory and says, oh, leave it. Just leave it. It'll do. Move on. But, of course, Banville can't move on.
Now, what about your readers? What about Banville's readers versus Black's? Or are you read equally or almost equally by all your readers?
I think readers are still trying to figure me out, still trying to figure out which they belong to. And, of course, the reason I took a pseudonym was simply to let people know that this was a different adventure that I was embarked on, that it wasn't an elaborate postmodernist literary joke that Banville was pulling by writing crime fiction. But I think, I don't know whether people believe it or not, I know that my friend Richard Ford was in Dublin when the first Benjamin Black book was published, and he was at dinner, and his dinner person next to him at dinner said to him, what's Banville up to with this book? And Richard said, well, I think he's just trying something new. I said, no, I don't believe that. No, there's something very dark and deep going on here. But there isn't. This is what you see is what you get. It's straightforward, crafted fiction, which I'm quite proud of. I mean, I, as I say, I didn't know that I could do it when I started doing it. And now that I've done 5 Benjamin Black books, I feel that he's fully grown.
You wrote an essay for us a number of years ago about James Joyce and Dublin and his influence, the shadow he casts over novelists in Ireland. It's not just Joyce, it's Samuel Beckett as well, Wilde and Shaw, Irishmen. How great are those influences today? How conscious are you of them as a writer?
It's difficult to be an Irish writer. I mean, with these figures behind us, I always liken them to Easter Island statues, these enormous stone figures looming over us, saying, you know, look at me, look how huge I am. What are you going to do, little man? So we have to somehow struggle out from under the shadow of those. We find various ways of doing it. But perhaps becoming Benjamin Black is one of my escape routes. But yes, it is. It is it's quite a formidable heritage, because we don't seem to do middle ground writers. We just seem to do either very great writers or really bad writers. And when a writer looks back, you know, a young writer in his late teens starting out, when he looks back, you know, he sees Jonathan Swift, Goldsmith, Oscar Wilde, Joyce, Yeats, Beckett, you know, the list is very large and very formidable. So it is frightening. But I suppose it's a stimulus as well. As to whether it's an influence or not, I don't know. People always say that I'm influenced by Beckett, but if I were to pick any influence, any Irish writer has influenced me, I would pick Yeats. Yeats is a far greater influence, certainly on my style, because I've tried to do the same kind of high rhetorical style that Yeats perfected. I like to think that I've added humor. Yeats, of course, famously had no sense of humor whatsoever.
Could it be that Yeats is the influence over Banville and maybe a little of Beckett in Black, or not so much?
Well, when I started being Benjamin Black, a friend of mine who's a great Beckett admirer said to me, I know what you're doing, Banville. You're doing what Beckett said he was doing when he went over to French. He said he was doing it pour écrire sans style, to write without style. And that may be the case. It may be that Banville was so sick of his own plotted style that he had to make a break for freedom. I mean, I've been doing this, as I say, since 2004, so, you know, it's been doing it for quite a while, but I still feel that I'm still venturing. I wouldn't like to feel that I have completely arrived. You know, it's always, every time I start a Benjamin Black book, I think maybe this time I'll find I can't do it.
It hasn't happened yet.
It hasn't happened, and I hope it won't. I don't think it will, but there is that feeling that's vague anxiety, which of course pushes one. It's always good to be a little anxious. Complacency is a great enemy.
Thanks so much, John Banville.
Thank you.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So this is actually a week when books, we're not talking about things you read on a device, actual books are doing well?
That's right. I come to you with a rare bit of good news. Independent booksellers and chains like Barnes & Noble had an incredibly good week. All year long, print sales have been suffering, but this week we had two huge books.
Which books, Julie? What are they?
Well, the George R. R. Martin book, A Dance with Dragons, which is the fifth installment of his Song of Ice and Fire series, which is this very sprawling, very creatively written and plotted fantasy series. And this book has been very eagerly awaited by a lot of fans. It was supposed to come out about 5 years ago, so they've been very upset that it took this long.
But they did not desert their hero. They turned out in droves to buy the new one.
They did. And what's unusual about this book is that the conventional wisdom in the book business has lately said that genre fiction, whether fantasy or romance or thrillers, does really well in e-books and not as well in print sales. So those readers have really been migrating to E and away from P, as they say. And what's happened with this book is that it was actually sold more copies in print than it did in electronic. 170,000 print copies on Tuesday, the first day it went on sale, compared to 110,000 copies in ebook. So this was a bit of a surprise to the publisher, and it was a bit of a surprise for the publisher.
Julie, I seem to remember when the Harry Potter craze was at its peak, we learned that it was independent booksellers as opposed to the big chain stores like Barnes & Noble that reaped the biggest windfall. Why is that?
Well, a lot of independent booksellers sell without discount. So with a book like the Martin book, it was a $35 list price, and a lot of independents sell it for that price. So they make more money on the book than a lot of the chains would, who sell it at like a 30% discount.
And why do so many readers then flock to independent stores rather than go to the big chain stores to buy a book like this? Why not just buy it for a lot less?
Well, some of it is just perhaps loyalty. Some of it is because they hear about these kind of books through their independent booksellers who do a lot of hand selling and really push these books. And in some cases, the independent might be the only bookstore in town.
Okay, now what about the other blockbuster? Also something of a surprise.
Yes, Simon & Schuster announced this week that J.C. Dugard's memoir, this is the California woman who was kidnapped and imprisoned. She's written a memoir, and that sold 175,000 copies on Tuesday. Most of those were in ebook form, but Simon & Schuster said that this had set records for them and that they've already gone back to press five times and have almost 500,000 copies in print.
Now, this isn't the woman who was living in a tent or something, but
yes, and she's gotten a lot of press around her story. There was a huge excerpt in People magazine, and I believe the cover, Diane Sawyer, interviewed her. So there's just been this incredible blockbuster hit for Simon & Schuster, and partly thanks to just how much public interest there is in her story.
Julie, we know that when a print book is selling tremendous volume, great rapidity, the publisher orders more copies to make available. What happens with ebooks when there's a great run on them? Are they just infinitely available?
Yeah, it's a great thing for the publishers because they don't have to worry about how big the print run is and distribution and how quickly they can get a book reprinted. There's an infinite supply right there and ready to be sent to the consumer with the touch of a button.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Esmeralda Santiago is an accomplished and best-selling memoirist and novelist. She has an ambitious new book called Conquistadora. It's reviewed for us by Gayutra Bahadur, who says that with her tough portrait of a female planter, and we'll hear more about that, Santiago speculates charitably but unromantically about those who didn't speak in another era. She takes us to the events of the past as if they were rooms, invoking a place that's long gone. I'm delighted that Esmeralda is here to talk about her novel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is a historical novel. It's actually based on the experiences of a fascinating person. So tell us about her.
Yes. Ana Larragoiti Cubillas is a character that I invented from many, many years of research, reading, trying to understand Puerto Rican history as opposed to world history, even discovering my own ancestry, which is really the beginning of this journey. And she kept appearing in my dreams, really, as somebody that to me was very, very real, really existed. I'm not psychic or anything like that, but unlike my other books, this one was an obsession with this particular woman who was in many, many ways like me, but in many more ways not like me. And so I had to learn to love her.
Well, tell us about her. Who was she?
Well, Ana was a young woman from Seville, the only daughter of an aristocratic family. She, because she's a woman, she cannot inherit her family's wealth, and so this is one of the reasons she decides she has to make her own way in life. And so the way that she does it is she manages to get a young man to fall in love with her. He happens to be an identical twin, and his twin falls in love with her as well. And she convinces them that they should all move to Puerto Rico, where they have inherited a sugar hacienda. And this is her way to get to a place that she's been dreaming about. She had found the journals of an ancestor who had been in Puerto Rico with Ponce de León 300 years earlier.
And this novel, it's the 19th century. It's an era of plantations and slavery.
Yes.
She's the mistress of this little world that she dominates. And yes. Who are some of the people she...
Well, some of the people who are around with her are the overseer, whose name is Severo Fuentes, and he is also a Spaniard who comes a few years before she arrives in Puerto Rico and who has been a slave trader. And when he is hired to run the labor force, she's the person that she's most directly working with because she's in charge of the physical needs of all the slaves. She has to give them their food. She has to make sure that they're clothed, and she has to take care of their spiritual needs, as it were. So he's somebody that's very, very important in her life, and he's the one who really makes it possible for her to run the plantation because her two, Ramon and Inocente, the twins, once they get there, they're really not quite prepared for the challenges of being an hacendado. And so she becomes to depend on Severo to run the operation at the same time as she learns how to be an hacendada so that she can do as much of it as possible. She really has this vision of herself as somebody who does the work, not just who has the work done for her. She's willing to work and wants to do it and takes great pride in the fact that all these privations and challenges just don't beat her down.
Esmeralda, one of the issues that comes up often, particularly in recent years in discussions of slavery, both in the continental United States and elsewhere, was the relationship between women and slaves, because their perception, as you say, was very different, and their interactions with the slaves were different. And our reviewer says that your character is even something of a proto-feminist. Explain that contradiction to our listeners.
Okay. Well, in the process of the research, I found many situations in which women inherited haciendas because their husbands had passed away or because their fathers. And so all of a sudden, they had this in their hands and they had to deal with them. Most of them actually either passed on the hacienda to a brother or their husbands, or usually a man. Woman's not supposed to do that. But when I realized that some women were inheriting haciendas, I said, well, I can't imagine that they would all would have just given it up. I would imagine that, you know, at least one would have been completely enamored of the place that they had grown up in many cases, or that gave them an opportunity to have freedom that they couldn't get in any other way. And so Anna, for me, is somebody that probably did exist, but these women are not in the history. They were too busy to write about their own lives, but also the culture didn't allow for women like this to be celebrated in any way possible. And so I decided that I was going to bringing back someone who I know existed, but who we have not met before because they were invisible in the history.
Esmeralda, you've mentioned some of the research you did. Talk a little more about that, how you are able to gain the command and confidence of an earlier era so you can write about it with real authority.
I've been working on this book for over a decade. I began to read the history of Puerto Rico. I was searching for my own ancestry, and the more I looked for the landless campesinos, which is what my family comes from, the more I realized that we are not in the history except as numbers. I also know that from my father's side, at least, there were Africans, and I couldn't tell you whether they were free or slaves. There's no way to tell because I don't have the information. So I began to read the research, the histories, everything that I could find, all of it in Spanish, most of it in very flowery 19th century language, which I then had to translate into more modern language just for me to understand it, and then subsequently to translate it into English because my books are written in English.
Esmeralda, how do you capture the tone and dialect and cadences of not only foreign language, but a departed time in a contemporary novel?
It was really challenging for me to find the voice for this book because, remember, these characters are speaking in Spanish and in other languages. People came from all over Europe to Puerto Rico to work in the sugar haciendas. So I am listening in my head their particular dialects from various parts of Spain and Europe. I'm translating them into English, into an English that is my voice and that is contemporary and that conveys both a time and our time as well. So it was very, very difficult and challenging, but I hope I did it.
Thanks so much, Esmeralda.
Thank you.
That's Esmeralda Santiago, whose new novel, Conquistadora, is reviewed in this week's book review. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Don't tell me there's not a whole lot new on the list this week.
Sam, I'm here to tell you there is not a whole lot new on the list this week. The bestseller list still seems to be in a kind of midsummer swoon. There are no new books on the nonfiction list. Laura Hillenbrand is still on top with Unbroken. She's marking her 34th week, and she's followed by Eric Larson in The Garden of Beasts. Nothing new over there.
Is there a little more bounce going on the fiction side?
Maybe a little. There are a few new books on the list, including Tess Gerritsen's latest cop novel. It's called The Silent Girl. It enters at number 3. James Patterson is still on top with Now You See Her, but really the list is in this kind of state of suspended animation while it waits for George R.R. Martin to make his appearance. I am going to double down on my promise to eat my complete collection of Harry Potter books if he does not enter at number 1 this week. His book, of course, was out this Tuesday, but the list this week only reflects sales up until last Friday. There was a little bit of intrigue swirling around the book. A couple of weeks ago, it emerged that Amazon Germany had accidentally started shipping A Dance with Dragons. That's the 5th installment in the series, ahead of its very strict embargo. And Martin, who keeps a very active blog presence, was not happy about this. He posted on his blog, "If we find out who is responsible, we will mount his head on a spike." And something tells me he's the kind of guy who actually owns a spike.
Jenny, explain why Martin, tremendously successful, would actually be annoyed or worse that his book is becoming available before it's supposed to be. Why does this bother him?
On the blog post, he said that he was really concerned about people posting spoilers on the internet. Apparently, there are a lot of those floating around. Some of them he claims false. I mean, I don't know this, but I would guess that he and his publisher both really want the book to, you know, enter at number one, which means they want to have all of the sales kind of concentrate in this big event-like launch. And, you know, sort of sales leaks sort of get in the way of that.
Jenny, in your column this week, you mentioned a proposal to limit the bestseller list to authors who've never appeared on it before. What would that do to this week's list?
Well, it would completely vaporize this week's list. You are right. The critic Michael Derda, formerly of the Washington Post, had a sort of provocative essay in the Literary Journal Book Forum in which he kind of complained about the bestseller list, as a lot of people do.
Complained about our bestseller.
Exactly. New York Times bestseller list, the bestseller list. And Derda said that, you know, basically it's become this sort of club of a self-perpetuating club of writers who have been there before. And once they can say on the cover of their book, preferably in raised foil lettering, New York Times bestseller, that helps sell their next book. So it becomes very tough for first-time writers to break onto the list. And this is certainly true. I've talked about this in the years that I've been doing this column. I've complained about it in the years that I've been doing this column. And, you know, this week, looking down the list, I don't see a single writer who hasn't been there before. Well, actually, there's one exception. Paula McLean. She had a big hit with The Paris Wife. She is still at number 13 this week. She had written a few previous books, but, you know, this time she launched herself onto the list. And I have a feeling next time she writes a book, it will also make the list.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.